This is a Squiz podcast. We're your shortcut to being informed. G'day, I'm Kate Watson, and News Club is the place to go for conversations about the news. In this special episode of News Club, I'm taking the opportunity to talk to someone that I consider one of the best content producers I've ever met. Bryce Corbett, welcome.
I wasn't expecting that.
Why not?
Well, that's very kind of you to say. Thank you. It's good to be here.
And I think by the end, people will see why. You have a CV that proves that point. So we'll get into that.
I've done some stuff.
Well, and this is the point. It's kind of difficult to quickly run through your CV. I thought perhaps instead we'd step through it and tackle the issues around each of the bits of work you've done that have brought you to where you are now, which is director, creator, producer, entrepreneur, host, lobbyist, basically the pack horse.
I feel so tired.
Yeah. It's the pack horse that carries Squiz Kids and it's a fair description.
Yeah. All right. I'll take that. Okay. Thank you.
I should point out at this point that, as you might have gathered, Squiz Kids is part of Squiz Media. It's a product we developed together. Bryce, we're friends. We've been colleagues for a long time now at the Squiz and beforehand, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Long way of saying, it's about time we sat down and did this. I'll introduce Squiz Kids, and I want you to talk about more about NewsHounds. So Squiz Kids started as a daily news podcast for primary age kids to listen to with their families. It grew to become a handy classroom activity and now has a team that you run that produces many podcasts, classroom material, and a free media literacy program called NewsHounds that's currently being completed by 2,200.
Yeah, just over 2,000 classrooms around the country, yeah.
For you and for me, it's about the mission, and talk to us about that.
Wow, yeah. No, it's interesting because you're right. I suppose because I'm so busy, I don't often take time to stop and think about what we've done and all of that which we've done to get to where we are. But NewsHounds, as you say, has very much emerged in the Squiz Kids universe as the whole. It's the real purpose piece. It is, as you say, a media literacy program for primary school kids, teaching them to recognize misinformation when they come across it online. I'm a dad. I'm a journalist of some 25 years experience. It became very clear to me after doing Squiz Kids, the daily news podcast for kids. After doing that for 2 years or so, it became very clear that there was this increasing need for children to be taught how to filter the information that they were increasingly getting on social media, for example. This was an epiphany that came to me really around the dinner table with my own children coming to me and saying, oh, I saw this on TikTok or I read this on Instagram. And as a journalist of 25 years experience, I would constantly contest them and say, but hang on, what makes you think that's right? Like, why do you think that piece of information that you are getting is correct? Well, it's been published. I saw it on Instagram. Somebody said it. So that was the germ, I guess, of the for the idea for NewsHounds to create a media literacy program which would go into primary schools and crucially get kids before they disappear down the social media vortex and teach them some really basic lessons on how to recognize misinformation when they come across it online.
And one of the things that has been encouraging about NewsHounds, I think, is that teachers really want this.
Oh, yeah.
So that they – and there's a gap in their knowledge as well in how to teach it.
Completely, yeah. And this is the thing. I mean, the take-up has just been, since we launched the pilot in November, 18 months ago now, we anticipated that, you know, teachers would embrace it, perhaps not with the gusto and enthusiasm with which they have embraced it. It's now, as we've already said, in over 2,000 classrooms around the country. So that's more than 45,000, almost 50,000 kids who are learning to spot misinformation when they come across it online. So it is very much, and I really passionately believe this, and it's an interesting place to be for like an aging journo.
You said it, not me.
Yeah, no, don't worry. I feel it with every day that passes. It's an interesting place to be at this point of my career where I am very engaged and extremely passionate about what is happening in the news space, but what the implications of that are for our democracy, which sounds really overblown. And I even, you know, I'm always very self-conscious even when I say that, but I really honestly believe that we are at a crossroads, I think, and we are sleepwalking our way into an irreversible disaster that we need to take steps to address, and we need to do those, I think, by educating the next generation around misinformation and disinformation.
And we know so many Squiz listeners, Squiz Kids families out there feel the same way. This is not a problem we've created and invented. It's something that our audience has told us time and time again. We're concerned about this. Can you develop tools to help us tackle this? And that's what we're trying to do. Mm. I think it's important to learn a bit more about you and your career. And when I was thinking about what I might ask you and things I don't know about you, take me back to little Bryce Corbett in primary school.
Little redhead.
What was he? I mean, and this is, I think it's important to demonstrate how far we've come and how much the world has changed.
Yeah.
What was it like for kids when you were at primary school?
Yeah.
Around news consumption and media? It was so different.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm what, 52 years old now. So my experience of media is so completely different to what kids these days are experiencing. I mean, if you want to talk about school, yeah, we were exposed to news perhaps once weekly at school via Behind the News. And that was well and good. But I guess more fundamentally, at home, there was always a newspaper lying around, or there was the 6 p.m. news was something that was appointment viewing. People would always tune in to watch the 6 p.m. news, or the radio would be on and you would be listening to radio bulletins. So there were only a small number of sources by which we received information. There were only a small number of, I guess, gatekeepers of that information. And this is the thing that we argue constantly with NewSounds, is like these days anybody can put information out there and they're not beholden to the same sorts of rules, regulations, expectations around it being correct or credible.
And so would you say that the Corbett household were normal in news consumption?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, my dad would bring home the afternoon newspaper, you know, that he would pick up.
And that was a habit that most families had.
Correct. Yeah. Did I read it? Probably not. But it was there. And I think by osmosis you picked up what was happening in the same way that the news was on in the evening, you know, and you would watch the television news and that was where you would pick up what was going on in the world. So, I think that was a pretty typical household and that was a pretty typical way in which media was consumed and information was imparted and consumed. But that has changed, obviously, enormously.
You decided to become a journalist.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, I think you were in a band for a while. That won't have been an option.
Yeah, I did. Well, yeah, that came a bit later when I was living in Paris. Yes, I was in a band for a while. And it wasn't like I came to some, I become a rock star or a journalist. No, that was always just a little bit of a folly on the side. But the journalism thing, I was good at English. You know, like most kids, I finished school not knowing what I wanted to do. And you scrolled through the list of university courses that were available and you looked at the marks that you got and you married them up and went, well, I guess I'll do communications. And then from university, I became a cadet journalist with News Limited, which at the time was the only place that was really offering cadetships and copy boys and training on the job training for aspiring journalists. And so I came out of university and I think like lots of people did, thinking, you know, I'm going to be the next Woodward and Bernstein and I'm going to bring down governments. And I went to work at the Daily Telegraph and I remember that.
I know where this is going. And so this is better for me. But
yeah, anyway. You're enjoying this. And so I had great aspirations of, you know, becoming a world-beating Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and they put me pretty promptly onto the gossip column. And at the time I was affronted. I was just like, but this is not part of the plan. Like, I've become a gossip columnist. I soon learned that it was the best possible training that any young journalist could have because at a very young age I was suddenly in a very high-profile role in the biggest tabloid in the country and I was exposed to some very powerful and influential people on a daily basis and I had to learn very, very quickly a skill that any good journalist should know, which is divining the motivation of the information you're receiving. So working out very quickly why people are telling you a piece of information and what possible gain they could get from
the agenda.
Yeah, what's the agenda behind it? Yeah. So I would, it was an extremely steep learning curve. It was a great way to hone the craft. And I look back on that now, still as one of the most formative journalistic experiences that I had.
you've gone on in your journalism part of your career to be a producer at 60 Minutes. Mm-hmm. You wrote Rear Window, which some might argue is a gossip column.
So that's the Financial Review's Rear Window.
In a different way.
Yeah. And the Financial Review, obviously, you're dealing with another level of people of influence and people of money and people of power. And that was, again, a real seat of the pants experience. Lots of anxious mornings waking up to see who's phoned you the next morning to shout at you.
I need to ask, in a departure from media literacy, just what the best yarn was. Like, I can't not ask that question.
For at Rear Window?
I don't know. Just across the 25 years.
I don't know. There have been so many. I think probably the most profound stories are the ones when I was working at the Women's Weekly.
And I want to talk about the Women's Weekly because we've missed a whole gap where you went to Paris, and I feel I really want to talk about the Women's Weekly because that's where I met you.
Yeah.
We worked together there briefly. But it's a different pace to what we see in media now. You had a monthly magazine to produce, and you were able to go deep on stories in a way that it's more difficult for journalists to do that now. And it's a real sort of a privilege to perhaps to have been able to have a job where you're able to do that in these times.
Yeah.
It's also where you wrote a number of books. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about that as well, but please tell me the yarn that you like the most. Well, if it came out of the Weekly, I'm curious as to what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it actually leads into the discussion around the books because it gave rise to two of the four books that I've written. I've written Rosie Batty's book, and I've had the great pleasure and honour of writing Taria Pitt's book, two remarkable Australian women for very different reasons, two women who have been brought to the attention, I guess, of the Australian population by virtue of unimaginable tragedies, but who have overcome the most incredible adversity to become respected advocates, inspirational speakers, just these incredible figures on the Australian cultural landscape. So, and those books both came out of encounters I had with both of those women whilst working at the Australian Women's Weekly and interviews that I did with both of them and relationships I managed to forge with them there. So, I mean, in terms of being most profoundly affected by stories, those probably would be the ones that I think I would say, because I wrote both of their books. Both of their books went on to become bestsellers. They're both great personal friends of mine now, and I feel really honoured to have played a small part in both of their journeys.
I remember, and I think I met you maybe during the Taria Pitt book.
Mm.
It was, I mean, obviously what they went through is something else, but being embedded in that story for that period of time, writing a book.
Mm.
Tell me about that.
So I wrote two books whilst I was in Paris. So that,
you did.
That
and I've only read one of them, I think.
Have
I
you?
Feel terrible now.
True.
But I read it before I met you, Town Like Paris.
Yeah, that's it.
I read it before I met you.
Yeah.
And loved
it. Yeah, before working at The Weekly, I was in Paris for 10 years. I'd studied French at school and university, had always loved French culture, had always loved the idea of potentially living one day in Paris. And by a weird series of circumstance and a lot of bravado on my part, I managed to land a job in Paris, and I thought I would stay there for a year. It turned into 10, 10 of the most amazing, wonderful years of my life. I met my beautiful wife whilst I was living and working in Paris. We had two beautiful children. It's a really fundamental part of our lives together, my life generally. Whilst there, I wrote that book, A Town Like Paris, which was a memoir about my life as a young man living in Paris, because travel memoirs at that time were really, really popular and particularly about France. And then I ghost wrote, and this was my first ghostwriting experience, I ghost wrote my wife's book. So my wife, Shay, was a dancer at the Moulin Rouge. She's a Brizzy girl. So two Aussies went all the way to Paris to meet and fall in love. And
it's quite the story.
Her. Yeah, it's not bad. And so I ghost wrote her book, Memoirs of a Showgirl, which was a kind of a pulling back the curtain on the Paris cabaret world as seen through the eyes of a young Aussie who had gone there to dance. So I had some ghostwriting experience and some ghostwriting chops. So when Rosie Batty asked me if I would write her book, I felt compelled to do so. Getting to your question, it was easily one of the hardest things I've ever done as a writer. I was still working full-time whilst writing a book and trying to meet a publisher deadline, which is not something I ever recommend to anybody. but given the subject matter, I was really deeply affected. You don't, in order to write it, ghost write a book well, you've got to capture the voice of your subject. You've got to get inside their head. And anybody who knows Rosie Batty's story knows that inside her head, particularly at that time, which was in the year after her son had been killed, that was a pretty dark place. And so as a ghostwriter, you take a lot of that on. I mean, I had to read and research and read a lot of very disturbing post-mortem reports, go into incredible amounts of detail that I would have nightmares and for a long time afterwards, I was really deeply affected by it. Still am.
And you have kids yourself.
And I had two toddlers at the time, and just imagining and putting into words on her behalf the unimaginable pain of not only losing one of your children, but losing it in the really violent circumstances in which they occurred, and arguably very preventable circumstances in which she lost her son, was really deeply affecting.
Wasn't sure this is where the conversation would go.
No, I know.
But yeah. I think it demonstrates the breadth of what you've done and what's led you to what you're doing now, And I mean, I can't emphasize enough the dedication Bryce has for Squeeze Kids. I mean, you were working full time when you started the Squeeze Kids podcast.
Yeah.
You're every night putting out a daily news podcast.
You and I remember, I mean, we were two of the OGs in terms of the Squeeze, you know. And when Claire first came up with the idea of creating the newsletter initially, you know, you and I were the ones that she spoke to. And in the initial iterations, in the first year, 18 months of the newsletter, I was editing it for her. Would send it to me. Yeah. She would send it to me and I would give it an edit and a polish. It didn't need much, it must be said, because she's so good at what she does. But so I've been there from the very beginning. And then, of course, Squeeze Kids, yeah, as you say, we launched Squeeze Kids whilst I was still holding down a full-time job. And happily now I've come on full-time and I can dedicate my whole time to Squeeze Kids and, crucially, the media literacy crusade we're on.
One of the things we talked about was this change. So we've talked about little Bryce and we've talked about early journalism years. Magazines are not what they were.
No, absolutely.
Just to go to books just very briefly once more, because I know Squizzes love books. And do you think it's an enduring format?
Yeah.
An enduring medium? Are you hopeful that it is, or do you think that's the case? Are kids still reading books?
Yeah, I think they are. I don't think they're reading any fewer books than they were. I mean, I think it was always a relatively small subset. I mean, kids, whether they were playing Pac-Man in 1980s or they're playing Roblox, like they were always things to distract kids and to take them away from books otherwise. So I think that books are incredibly durable as a form of distraction, entertainment, information. I remember the Kindle years and the great fear that was going to kill off the book, but it didn't. I think they're pretty durable. I think that they've seem to have weathered the storm relatively well, because a good story, well told, and good writing is just so compelling and always has been.
I think there's always a common theme with content, people, that good content will endure.
100%.
And that we have to believe that.
Yeah.
Even if it isn't true, we still have to believe it, because that's why we do what we do.
Yeah.
That's books. I guess the natural next question for me is attention spans, because you did touch on that just then.
Yeah.
You are now in classrooms seeing kids take part in Newshounds and the media literacy program. Mm-hmm. We've deliberately created it to be audio led.
Yep.
Is that to hold attention, and how much attention can a child hold? And what's your experience in the classroom when you watch it being taught?
So to your point around it being audio led, I mean, that was very deliberate on our part, because part of the reason that Squeeze Kids, the daily news podcast, took off in the way that it did and was so valued both by parents and by teachers was because it was not screen time. And it was using their listening comprehension skills. And these are a really important skill for any kid to develop. So teachers loved the idea that here was a resource that was not only teaching them about what was going on in the news in the world around them. It was doing so in a kid-friendly way. It was fun and engaging. We always make sure that everything we do is fun because otherwise kids are not going to be interested.
Say the sugar-covered broccoli line. I love the sugar-covered broccoli.
It is. It's the mantra, and I have it written above my my workstation. And it is that sugar-coated broccoli. That's what we're doing every day. We're putting out, we're dishing up sugar-coated broccoli because it's good for kids. They're eating it without knowing that it's good for them. They're consuming it without realizing it's actually doing them good. So the whole enterprise has always been underwritten by this idea that you can entertain and inform at the same time. In terms of kids and attention spans, well, obviously they've reduced enormously, we go into classrooms, as you say, and I present and teach News Hounds to kids. I should point out that the model is not about us going into every one of the 23,000 primary school classes around the country teaching it, because it's been designed in such a way that a teacher can pick it up and slot it into their lessons throughout the week over a 6 to 8 week period if they choose. There's a comprehensive teacher manual. We make it all very easy. It's been designed specifically by primary school teachers. And a shout out to my excellent colleagues, Christy Kujarina and Amanda Bauer, who I work with very closely on Squiz Kids. Amanda, especially as a former Time magazine journalist turned primary school teacher.
We found her. We found that needle in a haystack.
That's right. She's been so vital in terms of developing a resource that she knows is going to be useful in classrooms, but is crucially also curriculum aligned. Because if you want to get teachers to engaged in something, they're already so busy. They're not going to waste their time on something that doesn't speak to the curriculum. So we've made sure it's curriculum aligned. But what I do find when I go into the classrooms is that kids' attention spans have shrunk. And that I'm not saying anything that any parent out there doesn't.
So have adults.
Well, of course. Yeah, of course.
Just as a whole.
Yeah. And I know this. I sit at home and I watch my own kids watching stuff on their, Instagram or flicking through TikTok. Just that thumb, it just flicks up, it flicks up, it flicks up, it flicks up. They're making split second decisions about how much information they're going to be engaged with or interested in. But even if they're this fascinating development, I don't know if you've noticed on Instagram or TikTok even, is there'll be somebody talking in one screen, but then underneath it, there'll be some kind of like other thing going on, like somebody going off a ski jump or chocolate being made or poured or whatever. So it's this idea that you can't just have one thing happening at once. If you want to command kids' attention, then you need to have several things happening, several stimuli going on at once in order for them to actually take in the information. So the way people are processing information has changed enormously.
And it's one of the things I think about News Hounds is that it's just saying, be aware of that.
Yes.
Be aware of that.
Yeah.
And I think the stop, think and check
is the
sort of the News Hound's motto. Squizzy the News Hound. He's a little dog and he goes Squizzy around and he sniffs out misinformation.
So he gets around in his Sherlock Holmes outfit. He has a magnifying glass. He's a bloodhound, which are renowned. They're a species of dog renowned for having an excellent sense of smell. So his job is to wander around the internet and sniff out fake stories and then come back to Squiz Kids HQ and report back on the fake stories he's found and the fake news that he's discovered and the misinformation that he's found. And his mantra, as you say, is stop, think, and check. Squeezy the News Hound tells you to stop, think, and check every time you come across a piece of information online. Stop, first of all, because it's a piece of information. Think about who's made that information and what possible reaction they're hoping to get out of you or what possible motivation they have for making that piece of information, and then check it against credible sources of information. So it's this three-step process that we're trying to get kids to implement on a daily basis. It's really just about awareness raising and with kids educating them that they can't believe everything they see.
And one of the – I can hear people listening going, you know what, I even need to do that. This is something that I need to do. And you do talk about this reverse transfer of information. So if we're educating – it is fascinating because if we are able to educate a generation of people from the age of, 7 to 12, which News Hounds is aimed at, they will then be able to educate generations before that.
And one of the things, and this is fascinating. So we commissioned Queensland University of Technology to undertake an independent academic assessment of News Hounds because we wanted to make sure if we're sending this thing out into the world that it had academic rigor behind it. So they did a 6-month report into News Hounds and a whole bunch of focus groups and tested kids who had done it and parents who'd been exposed to it and teachers who had taught it. And we got this fantastic report back. One of the findings was, which surprised us and in a very pleasant way, was that kids were doing NewsHounds in the classroom, and then they were going home, and around the dinner table at night, their parents might chat about something that they'd seen on Facebook, and kids were challenging their parents and saying, is that true? Because Squizzy the NewsHound tells us to stop, think and check. So we had all these parents saying that suddenly their own media consumption habits were starting to change because NewsHounds had been teaching kids in their classroom to just be more wary.
Yeah, and I think this speaks to the wider point about why we really passionately believe in this, because it's actually for the greater good.
Correct, and which is why we've been talking to the government about it.
We are shamelessly promoting this as much as we possibly can to every single person who will listen to us, because this does need funding, this program. Where that comes from, we're very open-minded about. At the moment, we're very focused on the federal government.
Yes. It's not a natural space for us because we don't, you know, we've always
run commercial businesses.
We've run a commercial business. Yeah. We've never been those people who run around looking for grants and looking for handouts. But I passionately believe that this is not just about teaching kids to not fall for fake news. This is about the health of our democracy. And I know that sounds overblown. And I know that you know, I even catch myself when I say it because I just think like, God, that's a ridiculous thing to say. But I honestly passionately believe that we are sleepwalking our way into a kind of AI-generated dystopia unless we take steps now to educate the citizenry to look out for misinformation, be aware that it exists, be aware that there are bad actors out there who are trying to push agendas that are fundamentally not good for the health of our democracy.
And it's starting at the very start, like just saying there is misinformation out there and this is what it might look like.
Yeah, and look, international studies have shown that if you don't get kids before they have a smartphone, so if you don't get them before they're teenagers, then before they disappear down that social media vortex, then you're not going to get them. And this is why we've focused on primary schools. Like, there are media literacy resources out there for high school kids, and that's a fantastic thing, but you really need to get them at a primary school age. It's really important that they're learning their lessons in the same way that we teach our kids how to swim, in the same way that we teach our kids how to stop at the curb, look to the left, look to the right. You need to get these very basic life skills into them before they get to the age where they're no longer listening to you as an adult anyway. So that's why we focus very much on the primary school age. And in fact, I was awarded a Churchill Fellowship at the end of last year, and the Churchill Trust are sending me around the world to look at ways in which other countries have instituted media literacy education programs amongst primary school kids for that very reason.
And we will definitely get you to report back on that.
There'll be a lot of reporting back on that.
That is a fascinating conversation. I think we'll leave it there. I think the main thing to do now is to ask the audience to do what we would like them to do, which is
just spread the word. I mean, spread the word. If you're a parent and you have a teacher which in your life or in your children's lives, make sure they know about NewsHounds. Make sure they're aware that it exists. It's a free program. I'm not sure if I probably emphasized that, and I should have at the beginning. It's absolutely free. There is, and that's really important because you don't want media literate kids being divided across demographic and economic lines. So it's really important that all kids from all demographics have an opportunity to be taught media literacy. So make sure that your teacher is across it. Make sure the principal of your school knows that it exists and that they are talking to their teachers about it. Make sure that if you have any contact whatsoever with an MP, or if you've got any inclination to get in touch with your MP, let them know that media literacy is a really important issue for you and that Squeeze Kids and NewsHounds are doing something about it. We have been talking to the federal government, to the federal education minister, to the federal communications minister, to the home affairs minister. I mean, we have been down in Canberra. We've been lobbying this hard. We honestly, passionately believe this is a vital life skill for the 21st century, and we need everybody's help to get that message across.
You can find Squeeze Kids by searching for it in your podcast app. You can go to squeezekids.com.au, newshounds.com.au. All the links are in your episode notes. And if you're someone out there listening who might have a lead for us on funding, even outside of government, we're very keen to hear from you. Bryce@thesqueeze.com.au. I mean, I'm tempted to give out your phone number, but I won't. But it is, you know, obviously something that we care a lot about at The Squeeze more broadly.
Yeah.
And really glad to be able to put this in people's ears. Bryce, thank you for joining us.
My very great pleasure.